en wat hy doen nie, want hy doen omtrent alles. Ja, Don is activist, hy is skrywer, hy is kriminoloog, hy is journalist. Op die oomblik werk hy vir 'n organisasie wat omgewingsake ondersoek en hy kan nie wegbly van die gangs af nie. So Don, baie dankie vir, ja, vir jou tyd en vir die voorreg wat ons het om vandag met jou te gesels.
Theo, dankie. Ek is blij om hier te wees.
Dan kom ons begin sommer net met jou boek. Jy het al, dis jou derde boek oor bendes en jy stel ongelooflik belang in bende geweld binne en buite tronke. Hoe het hierdie een tot stand gekom?
Kan ek Engels gebruik? Want by Afrikaans is nie goed nie.
Jy is baie welkom. Kyk, hy het sy Afrikaans onder die gangsters geleer, nê? En die ding is, hy het 'n uitgebreide woordeskat en die woordfees het gevra, jy moet asseblief Engels praat.
Ek is skaam om bende taal te praat. I wrote this book, I thought it was going to be easy. I've written two others and I thought, okay, well, I'll bring them up to date. All the other ones were pre-apartheid, you know, up until 94. So let's have a look at what happened, you know, after the change. And I thought I'd just dust it off and bring it up to date. And then I started investigating and everything had changed. I had to actually start from scratch. That's the first thing. So it was much bigger than I realized. And the second thing is my wife said to me, you know, you're getting old. If you're in the departure lounge. So, you know, if you're going to write a book, it's got to have solutions. Don't waste your time just telling people about the troubles. Try and fix things now. So I said, well, yeah. So actually, this is my attempt to give something to the young people in South Africa because I'm really worried about them.
Yes, Don, en ja, dis fenomenaal wat jy gedoen het. Ek dink Jonathan Janssen het gesê, hy dink dat hierdie is een van die grootste bydraes in die sosiale wetenskap. En wat Don fenomenaal gedoen het, is eintlik om sielkunde, sosiologie, neurologie, ek kan nie glo die unbelievable verskynheid van al hierdie vakdisciplines, en hoe jy dit reg gekry het om dit logies te verpak binne dit is, dis amazing. Kom ons begin net met, jy trek Cape toe en dan skryf jy Gangtown. Hoe kyk jy na Kaapstad? Ek kan eerlik wees. Kyk, dis een van die wonders van die wêreld en dit is blink en is mooi, maar ons moet hom ook doodtrek.
I come from the Eastern Cape, so I came to Cape Town. And when I first arrived, there was District 6, and a friend of mine took me into District 6. And we at Gesaip, and there was everything there, and it was fantastic. There were really cool people. And I went away, and when I came back, there was this hole in the city. I was next door. And that was a shock. And as I started investigating and looking into this, I found that there's not such a thing as Cape Town, one town. There's two towns. There's that side and there's that side. And they're almost completely different towns. Even if you look at crime, if you look at the murder rates, that's a good, there's always a body. It's useful. I like, murder. It's good. Nice. Evidence is obvious. The murder rate on that side of town, under the mountain, around the mountain, I think is something like 6.4 per 100,000. Now that's about the same as New York or London or Paris. Op die Kaapse vlakte, in a place like Hanover Park, and especially what's this? There's some places where it's 200 per 100,000. Oh. And Cape Town, as a result of those stats, has the highest, one of the highest, it's one of the most dangerous cities in the world. Mm. It has the highest murder rate. That I think only Honduras beats us. The murder rate in South Africa is scary. I think it's higher in the same period as the war on terror in Iraq. Mm. More people are being killed here than in wars.
Yes. And what is a gang? Ek onthou destyds toe Staggie gesê dat die Heart Livings is nie 'n gang nie, dis 'n organisasie. En is baie maklik om dood te gaan, is verskriklik hard om te lewe. Wat, hoe definieer jy 'n gang? Wanneer is jy 'n gang? Wanneer is jy 'n syndikaat? Wanneer is jy 'n organisasie?
Ja. Just before I say that, I want to say that when we talk, I just got to clear this up. The murder rate, when we're talking about crime like that, everybody thinks gangs. Just staying on the murder rate for a moment, then I'll answer your question. Only about 11% of the murders are gang-related. The majority of deaths in Cape Town are caused by domestic violence. So one of my big first shocks was that I thought I was looking at a gang problem. I am looking at a gang problem. But I'm looking at a much bigger problem as well, and actually two bigger problems. One is a youth problem in which gangs are a part. Another is a domestic violence and general high levels of crime of which gangs are a part. I mean, we need to look at gangs, but we need to keep in mind that we have these other much bigger problems in a certain sense, and we can talk a little bit later about that youth problem. But just to get to you know, if I want to talk about Staggie, there are different kinds of gang benders. There's not just one thing. When I started unpicking what the gangs were, I came to a huge number of different kinds of things that could be called gangs. And a guy like Staggie is, the Hard Livings are somewhere in the middle. They're a corporation. They are just like a corporation. There's the CEO at the top, and they're the guys under him, and the people who work for him. These guys, they contract to do buildings. They have transport organizations. They operate in a hierarchical system. Another kind of gang works in a network system, and that is the networks rise and fall according to what the needs are. And there's another one which is what would it be? It's a clan system. It's built around families. It's built around street, that people understand each other in the street. So that's just the beginning of an understanding of the difference of gangs. But then, I mean, if you take a definition of gangs, I mean, my definition of gangs is very easy. It's a group of people with common interests who meet together for common purpose. Right, and if that purpose is crime, then that is a gang. That's my definition of gang. Now, when I look at that, Hard Livings are in the middle of that. Right at the bottom, you've got street kids who are playing gang. They're not doing anything bad, but it's, you know, you're a cop, I'm in the gang, or we're killing each other, and these are very small kids. And then you get the what I call warrior gangs. They're largely kids who are in Khayelitsha and places like that, the Amavuros, the Amavatos. And these are teenagers. They're 12, 13, 14, 15. This uniform is a school uniform. The weapons are carried in school bags, and they actually attack each other, and they kill each other. Mm-hmm. But it's all around masculinity and visi man and who's on top. But you know, that's a particular kind of gang. The Staggies and co are kind of their merchant gangs. They're buying and selling. That's what they're doing. And that's where a lot of the crime comes from, because if you're buying and selling drugs and things, there's a territory. You can sell in it, but you can't sell out of it. So a lot of the violence is around those boundaries. But beyond that, I mean, just to drift through those, you get syndicates who operate beyond the gangs as a super gang. You get transnational gangs which bring stuff in and out, and they are Nigerians, they are Colombians, they're Russians, they're Chinese, the Tongs. There's a whole range of those, but you don't have to stop there. You know, people in corporations who money launder are gangs, in my term. People in government who work out kickbacks are a gang. They're a group of people with common purpose to undermine the law. If you read the latest Noseweek, there's a transcription in there of a conversation of people in the highest levels of government. And, I mean, it's amazing to read that. They are total gangsters.
Don, jy was baie blootgestel al in die apartheidsjare toe Don eintlik saam met hulle gaan bly en saam met hulle gaan leef. En Don het ook vir my gevra, moet ons, ek sal vir jou gangster saam bring ook. Toe sê ek, nee, ek is nog nie reg vir dit nie, net nou vraag jy verkeerde vraag hierso. Maar jy leef saam, jy het soveel blootstelling. Vertel iets van hoe gangs was in die apartheidsjare en hoe is dit nou? Jy weet, wat het verander? Is daar 'n verandering?
Yeah, see, things have changed, but they haven't changed as much as you'd imagine. You know, there were gangs in District 6, the Globe Gang. They were gentlemen. They had hats like yours, or even better. And they had smart cars, and they were American, really, in their whole style. And they were a vigilante group. If young guys got out of hand, they'd sort them out. And they got a little bit worse, and then they started stealing and, you know, stuff like that. But that's the kind of gang they were. Gang development is in lockstep with poverty, all right? And poverty has got worse in so many of these kind of areas after 94. It was bad before, it's worse now. So the change is that the gangs are a relationship, not alles nie dinge nie, they're a relationship. And as the situation around them changes, that relationship changes. And so they're very influenced by what's happening around them. We have an education system which is falling apart, and we can talk about that a bit later. We have poverty which is increasing. We have an in-migration into Cape Town which is one of the highest in the world, so there's overcrowding. And we have a drug situation here. The illegal drug trade in this country is estimated at 23 billion rand a year. So we have a massive industry, and a lot of it is centered in Cape Town. So the changes are that they've got bigger, they've got smarter, they've got international connections, they've got connections right into government. Zuma is said to have had a meeting with the gang leaders at one stage, facilitated by Mark Liffman, my life is at risk, so I won't mention what Mark Liffman does, but so, you know, that's the change. They've got more professional.
Dan kom ons gesels oor, jy weet, wat is nog oorsake? Armoede, sosiale omstandighede, wat trek veral jong mense in dit in?
Why are young people pulled in? That's a big question, Theo. It's a big question because all young people, all teenagers like the situation in which gangs are. What are they? They're something which pushes against the adult world. They're places where you meet your bra and your friends, and you have to do performance to make sure that you're cool. Cool is a huge thing with gangs, but it's a huge thing with all teenagers. And you've got to have the right stuff. You've got to have your cell phone. You've got to have your right clothes. You've got to look right. So there's a whole range of things that the gangs are just an extension of what teenagers normally do. And that's interesting, because gangs could be a way to find a solution to gangs, because if you keep kids in if you have all of those things within your solution, which is in a gang, you're starting to take kids beyond gangs. But that's another debate. But there are other problems which were quite a shock to me. And one is fatherlessness. You know, I had an organization that has taken thousands of kids, mainly young men, through ritual processes. Every single one of those young men had a father problem. Absent, violent, undermining, stuff like that. One third of the kids in this country have been brought up within a single parent family, largely by a mother. So, you know, a young man who doesn't have a father, particularly, is ashamed. Inside deep, he's ashamed. I wasn't good enough to be loved. And in the teenage years, that shame mixes with anger, and that fear, that shame anger mix is a toxic mix. It's dangerous, especially when you've got a gun in your hand. So the father problem is a big one. The mother problem was a real shock to me. Mothers in my book have always been the goodies, and they still are. They're wonderful. You know, they bring up the kids when the fathers disappear. But there are problems. There are big problems, and an area I didn't expect to get into was epigenetics, which my daughter did genetics, and her textbook, she gave me a textbook, she said, "You want to know about genetics, here it is." It didn't even mention epigenetics, and it's only 5 years old. That's how new a discipline it is. And what epigenetics is, just to try and describe, because as a journalist, I have to make things simple. I mean, I have to kind of boil them down until I understand them. And what it is that we've always known that there are two strands that make a cell, which makes a person, and that's the father's DNA and the mother's DNA. All the informatie is daar, and it comes along, and it's a person. And that is how we understood genetics. What they've just discovered recently is that the cell wall is a bioslimdung. It's got all sorts of little ways of getting information in. Moment by moment, the chemical information, and it takes that information and it passes it on to the proteins within the cell and says, go to the DNA and make a head, make a brain, make an ear. So what we've just discovered is that moment by moment information is actually part of the construction of a young person from cell all the way up. It happens all the way through the 9 months, and it happens for 2 years after that. The first 1,000 days is important because the genetic structure is being created in that time. Now, keeping that in mind, what happens if the mother's drinking? What happens if she's taking drugs? What happens if she's hyper-stressed? What happens if she's food insecure, doesn't have the right vitamins and stuff like that? That is all information going in. Now, that doesn't damage the cell. It doesn't damage the what it does is it tells that child that there's certain conditions it's going to have to deal with in life, the rough conditions. And what does that mean chemically? It means that it's going to say to that kid, it's going to build it around more dopamine. Dopamine is the fighting gene. It's the go out and get the stuff. It's sex drive, it's aggression, it's all of those things. Serotonin, what you insert, just behind your eyes, serotonin in the forebrain, the prefrontal cortex, is the stuff that says, wachabiki, take it easy, step back, think about this. Now, what happens in that transition, that prenatal and early postnatal transition, is that these kids get more dopamine and less serotonin. And that stuff comes out in the teenage years. They become fighting kids. They have learning problems at a certain level because they don't take time to think about it. They just go. They're high energy. Oscar Pistorius is my perfect example of a dopamine kid. Incredibly good at going for it, but that reflection process is not so good. So that's another thing that I didn't think I would have to learn epigenetics or genetics to understand this stuff. But there are long-range studies coming through from New Zealand and from Holland and in the States. They've been tracking people from pre-birth through for 40 years, 35, 40 years. And they're finding those early years, if there are certain conditions in those early years like I've been describing, the chance of people, young people, getting into trouble with the law, dropping out of school, is something like 60 to 70% higher.
En dan, ja, yes, dis verskriklik om dit te hoor, want jy weet, nou sit ek en dink, hier kom hierdie arme kind wat so geprogrammeer is, in 12, 13, met daai belangrike oorgang na adolescentie toe, kan hy gehelp word? Jy weet, as daai programme daar geskrywe is, wat is jou ondervinding met kinders wat jy daar probeer begelei?
Ja, you know, one of the things that comes out of that is if these kids offend, is it their fault? That's a big legal question. You know, can we challenge in court a kid who's had that sort of beginning that they didn't make happen, but they're high energy, high aggression, they cause trouble, they murder somebody or they beat somebody up, can we charge them? It's a in criminology, that's a very big question. You know, who's culpable? Whose fault is it? What do we do with kids like that? Well, you know, it's first of all, that situation is that not irreversible entirely. If the mother has a hard pregnancy and we look after her, that stuff kind of comes right in the first few years if the kid has a supportive, loving situation. The thing about love is it's chemical. You can love a child to intelligence in the womb, in the first few years. That support, that love, that stuff actually has a genetic impact on the kid, which I think is quite remarkable. We've always known what love is. We feel it, but now we can actually see it in the development of a human being, and it is a wonderful, beneficial force. Working with kids like this, that high energy can be used. That's, you know, I'm not saying that all kids in gangs have genetic background, but there is that element, that sort of wild stuff that goes on around them, and that's energy, and energy can be used. Energy is a wonderful thing. We, you know, I'm a trustee of Chrysalis Academy, and we a lot of what we do is outdoor stuff. We take the kids into the wilds. They sleep in the wilds. It's kind of vision quest stuff, and we scare them because they've never been outside before and slept rough. And we get a circle together and we create trust among these kids, and we make them heroes for having done that kind of stuff. We do all that energy stuff. And these kind of kids do wonderfully at that. You know, one of the solutions to gangs is to build gangs that go somewhere else. That energy, that wild stuff in a gang is what the kids are looking for. That's why they're in a gang.
Don't praat daaroor, want jy gebruik die woord rite of passage baie, en dat dit 'n baie belangrike proses is om die begeleiding te doen. So as ons initiasie hoor die woord, dan slaan ons dekking. Jy weet, dit is nie goed in 'n Afrikaner kultuur nie, dis baie gestigmatiseer. Net hoekom is 'n rite of passage, of noem het nou initiasie, so wesentlik belangrik vir 'n kind om deur te gaan?
You could only ask that question having forgotten your own teenage years. We all go through that process. You have to separate from your parents. You have to be an adult. How do you be an adult when there's all these big adults around? You've got to back off. You've got to go through a process of understanding who you are. And there's, you know, the sexuality stuff comes in. There's new stuff that you experiencing, and suddenly, I mean, anybody who's lived with teenagers knows that suddenly the adults are not important, the kids, the peer group is incredibly important. That's the beginning of new relationships. That's how life works, because those become the people who through life that are going to be next to you. That's why it's important. So in a certain soft sense, that's what a rite of passage is about. But there are much deeper psychological things there, and we use rite of passage in Chrysalis, and I had an organization called USICO, which for 15, 16 years was doing this stuff, and it's a coming to awareness of who you are as a separate entity from your parents and from the world around you. That's the best way of putting it. But those steps along the way, we have lost in the West. We don't know that anymore. We don't. I'll tell you a story. Actually, it's the best way to describe it. I was doing some work in the Transkei, and I was looking at how traditional societies deal with misdemeanors, crime, and problems. But I just happened to be at a beer drink. There were about 50 men, and they were all sitting around, passing around a groot kan beer, and they were talking. But what it was actually, I discovered, was it was when a young man is going through the maqueta process, the transition, which is a classic rite of passage. The circumcision is just a small part of another whole process that's going on. What this young man had to do before the actual circumcision was join a circle of men. Yeah. With three things that he had to do. He had to join the circle, he had to drink the beer, and he had to say something. That's all. Now, you must remember, in Xhosa culture, a young man is a kwedin until he's a man. He's a niks. A kani of wurtse in the company of men, because his word is not taken. Mm-hmm. And he knows that. So he's got to... And I watched this young guy coming down, and he was quite nervous. And he sat down. They made space for him, and he sat on a box, and he sat there for a while. And then the beer came round, and they passed it to him, and he had a drink, and and I could see this guy was like, what's going to happen? He was really nervous. And finally, after a long time, he said something. I don't know what he said, because my course is not that good. And 50 men stopped and went, hey, that's right. Ege, yeah, you are right. And they carried on talking. And I was watching him. He became a man like that. It's the most chilling, thrilling experience I've ever seen in the transformation of a human being. Mm-hmm. His whole body changed. The way his face formed itself, the way he sat up, the way he became part of that circle. And that was one of the beginning processes which got me to explore transition in adolescence. And what is a rite of passage that has that level of power to transform somebody? It's affirmation. What is the value of affirmation in this process? It's profound. These kids need affirmation, which is why the absence of fathers is such a problem. They need social affirmation. And we don't give it to them. We don't give it to them in school. We don't understand that process. And when they demand affirmation with a knife or a gun, we put them in jail.
Yes, thank you, Don. Dit help my om het te verstaan, vooral toe jy nou die story vertel van, jy kon sien iets klik in hy kind.
Ja.
En ek weet, ek kan nie onthou wie dit was, ja, ek dink het was Richard Rohr, hy sê, as hy nou praat oor initiatie, this is not psychology, this is cosmology. Weet jy, dit is nie een proces wat jy werk op een kind, dan word hy iets nie, dit is hoe ons gemaakt is, soos een dochter wat begint te menstrueer, jy kan het net affirm, maar daar is een automatische klik in die kosmos, jy weet met dit. Dan die ander ding wat ek baie aan dink, die rol van godsdienst in gangs. Ek onthou destijds met Staggie, was een van die groot bekommernisse toe hy bekeer, en hy gaan van kerk tot kerk, en hy preek, God en gang, het is in die mix, wat, hoe werk het?
Well, first of all, they say there's only two ways to get out of a gang, God or a bullet. And that's true. Theo, the interesting thing is that religion and gangs are a ritual. There are very formal rituals in religion. They are steps, they are paces by which you go through a process. The entrance into gangs is very ritualized as well. So ritual is very understood by young people in gangs. And that's made deeper by the prison gang system. Let me make a bubble like this. The prison gangs are the 26s, 27s, 28s, are very old gangs, over 100 years old. They are super ritualized. They're military rituals. They're generals and sergeants and policemen and all sorts of things. And those choppies that they have are actually indications very often of their rank.
Don't tell us, Nate, what is it, 26, 27, 28?
That's a 28.
Okay.
5 and 3. They're gangs which formed in prison because doing time is having lots of time. Mm. They come out of the Boer War, actually, the Anglo-Boer War, and that time, the uniforms and stuff. And I won't go into how they were formed. They're just, there's a whole history. There's a whole big fat book by Charles von Onsland about the formation of those gangs. But the 28s are a gang that uses sodomy. They can have sex between men. The 27s are the sort of roof. They steal and things like that. And the 26s and the 27s are the police. That's how it works. There's a kind of difference, and they're very fierce entrances. A lot of stabbing and stuff like that. But the point is that those were entirely inside the prison. They didn't come out. That was after 93, lots of international gangs came into the country. That's what happens when a country's in transition. It's vulurach, and you know, business comes in, but international crime comes in. So all the gangs in Cape Town that were selling drugs and various things suddenly had an opposition from tongs and mafias and all sorts of things. And what they did is they pulled in the military gang ritual out of prison into the process of the streets. They pulled that military process in and used that ritual process to push out the foreign gangs. They just killed them, or they pushed them out, or they stole the money, or it became a very, very fierce and unrecorded battle in the 90s between the foreigners and the locals. And that deep ritual that is now embedded in the gangs is almost religious. It's you do not go against that. It's God is the general, you know. So that relationship between gang work, gang rituals, and religion is easy for them. And they respect, if a kid wants to get out of a gang, the only way he's going to get out is through religion, to move into Islamic or Christian space. They respect that for those reasons. Mm. It's a long answer to it. Mm.
Don, jy het nou genoem van die 90s. Dit was ook die tyd met Pagat en ander organisaties, wat nou ook vandag nog baie hoor is, a war on drugs. Jy weet, wat was die effect van wat Pagat in die war on drugs begin doen het?
You know, if you look at Pagat, it's a vigilante organization, and it had all the problems that vigilantism has. They go too far. Vigilantes arise when you have huge movements in Khayelitsha now. They're not Pagat, but if somebody screams thief and the community catches him, they'll kill him. Almost is, you get that instant vigilantism. And that happens when people lose trust in the law and order process. Now, Pagat was it's a middle class, largely Muslim movement that arose at a time when there were drugs coming into the country, and they wanted to stop it. So their urge and their reason for starting was a very good one. They wanted to stop drugs and they wanted to stop dealers. And because there was no police, they became their own police force. And I've been on a raid with Pagat. It's really scary. These guys with kind of these hoods and things move through the streets, and they identify a house where a dealer is, and they break the door down and they beat the hell out of him. I thought this guy screams. I thought he was dead, but he wasn't, not quite. But what happened is they went too far. They started killing people. There were deaths. I don't know whether you remember the Rashad Stachy was burnt publicly and shot. And then there were all sorts of bombings, and they were linked. I'm not sure if they were, but they were linked to Pagat. And a lot of these guys went to jail. But they've come out now, and Pagat is reforming. So I really don't know where that's going to get to now.
Dan wat is die oplossing? En ek weet dit is 'n verskriklike simplistiese vraag, maar as jy nou vir ons moet sê, ek dink dis wat julle kan doen om 'n aktiewe rol te speel, want ek moet eerlik sê, toe ek jou boek lees, ek het gevoel soos hierdie ou, wat sê hy, deeply troubling. Jy weet, jy verloor slaap. Jy weet, as jy net met die werklikheid sit, so wat kan ons doen?
There's lots we can do. There really is. I can just list them. We've got to, apart from supportive families, mothers and fathers, there's the failure there. We've got to do something there. And we have to do that at state level. We have to fix the education system. You know, half the kids who start school don't make matric. You've got something like 3.5 million kids aged 11 to 24 are not in school, not in training, not in work. They're in the streets. I mean, that alone tells you what gangs are. 317,000 are in Cape Town alone. 317,000. I'm proud of the 200,000 of those who aren't in gangs, because, you know, it must be the urge must be very strong to be in gangs. So you know, we have to fix the education system. And just let me say that I know how to fix the education system. The education system we're using is neck up. This kophood, it's built around neoliberal Western concepts mixed with Victorian pillars of what we should learn. And it's largely nonsense. The kids born today are only, they're going to retire when? I mean, they're going to retire in 2083? We don't know what skills they'll need. So we've got to fix the education, and there's only two things that you need to teach. They've got to be able to read and use numbers. One is a love of learning. We teach people what to learn, but not how to learn. And if we just taught them how to learn, they'd teach themselves, largely. They would find the interest to do that. The other is to stay healthy, just have a body that works. You know, I was in the dorm class at school. All my friends went and did Latin and all these things, and I was the guy that did woodwork and metalwork. And yes, I liked it. I mean, I went to school because I was building things, and I was on lathes, and I was, you know, this little guy with a massive lathe, and if you leave the key in the chuck, it goes through the roof if you switch it on, or your head, there's this massive lathe, and I'm making something. You know, I'm in control of this machine. It was a beautiful feeling. Everything else at school, apart from English, which I loved, because I had a nice teacher, was rubbish. We have lost the desire in school to teach hand knowledge, hand wisdom. We're losing that. Increasingly, we're going neck up. And these kids are bored at school. And the trouble is that hand skills have been downvalued. If you have head skills, you can become a professor or a doctor or a teacher or something. And that's cool. That's good in life. If you use your hand, you're a plumber or a carpenter or something. It doesn't have value. That has the value of the future. The future, and I have seen the future, is that we're going to have factories full of people on laptops or computers doing things. And the people who earn the money will be the people who fix your car, who build your house. Those are going to be the guys. You know, that is the future. So the education system's wrong. I can just list more. We've got to rethink prisons.
Yeah, and decriminalize drugs.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me talk
just
about
that.
Just
say something about that.
You know, the war on drugs has failed, Theo, and it's shocking. We've spent billions of dollars worldwide, and thousands of people have died as a result of this war on drugs. And I don't think drugs are a good idea. I don't think people should take drugs, but they do. Half the people in our prisons, half the clutter in our courts, half the criminalization of people on the streets, and probably two-thirds of the kids that are getting picked up by the law, they are drug-linked crimes. I was thinking, we this is ridiculous. You know, there are drugs; they're not that cool, but we're not fixing it. We haven't got the solution. And then I discovered Portugal. Portugal decriminalized drugs in 2002, and the whole EU said, "You're crazy. I mean, this is going to be the drug center of Europe." It now has the lowest drug offense and use in Europe. The reason is that you can have up to 10 days of any drug. If you have more, they take you in, not to the police station, to a sort of therapeutic center, and they say to you, what are the problems in your life that make you need to take drugs? Because what they discovered is that the reason most people take drugs is sadness. Just that. It's amazing. They're using drugs as a chemical hug for the failure of relationships around them, very often. There's the thrill drugs and the ecstasy drugs, and that's, you know, they tend to pass. So I think that we could decriminalize drugs and then manage it as a health problem. Reduction of harm is more important than imprisonment of offenders. Mm-hmm. We could fix it by decriminalizing mm-hmm. drugs, but we need a decent system like Portugal has to deal with those problems.
Dan, die laaste vraag, en dan kan julle nou lekker saamgesels. Ek sien hier's 'n paar predikante ook. So, help ons, wat kan 'n geloofsgemeenskap doen met hierdie kinders en met bende geweld? As jy ons raad moet gee, jy's ons dominee nou.
What do we do about them?
Ja, wat kan kerke doen?
You know, churches are an important part of the solution. I don't think they know it, and I don't think they go far enough, but they could. They could. And really, let me start with a story. You know, at Chrysalis Academy, where I'm a trustee, a lot of kids now come and want to be part of it, and they get interviewed. And this one woman was telling me that a young guy, tough-looking 18-year-old, came along, and he sat down. And she said, well, tell me about yourself. And he starts talking, and he got up and he walked away. And she went like, what happened? You know, what, did I say something wrong? I hardly said anything to him. Anyway, she carried on, and finally he came and sat down again. And she said, what did I say wrong? He said, nothing. Why? So she said, well, why did you get up and walk away? Ah, he said, nobody's ever asked me about myself before. I didn't want you to see me cry.
Sure.
So what the churches need to learn and what organizations need to learn is that there's very hurt kids out there that are looking for that kind of engagement by older people. And we give them, we criminalize them, and we label them, but we don't give them that acknowledgement and love that they require to be whole. What I've discovered along the way, I was looking for a path that I could say something in this book and say something to Chrysalis, because in a way I'm a consultant to them. What is that process? And in looking for that path, I found it largely within the religious framework. And what is that path? The first thing is that that somebody has a crisis, and they are shaken by this crisis, and they look around for help. Very often, these kids are shaken by a crisis that is a family crisis, and they find a gang. Now, that shaking up is a psychological shake-up that opens them to the possibility and a desire and a need for new things. The second part of that process is, and this is what a church provides, is a mentor, somebody who says to them, I hear you, you are here, I acknowledge you, and I will walk this path with you. That's what they need, because very often, even if they have a father, it can't be that father. You and I will probably remember people who did that. Everybody will remember somebody that did that for you. And the next thing is that the young person has to do things that make them look good in the eyes of the anerkenners wat rondel is. In your peers, you have to look good. So you have to perform, or there needs to be performances that you go through that you shine and look good with. Then there has to be, and linked to that is there have to be rituals. Young people love rituals. I mean, if you wonder what the clothing is, what the right colors and the silver, that's all ritual, actually. It's modern ritual. And the things and the language they use, it's all ritual. Teenagers are ritual makers. So you have to, if you have some program, the church has ritual. Church is all about ritual. And another thing is quietness. You have to, there has to be a time where you sit down and go, what the hell am I doing here with my life? There has to be a space. Life is going so fast that people don't do that. They run, and they go to sleep, and they wake up in the morning, and they run. They don't have that time for reflection. Now, a church has the possibility of providing that space. Mm-hmm. All of those things, churches, and by church, I don't mean Christianity, I mean all religious mm-hmm. systems. Because they are hundreds and, in fact, thousands of years old, they know those processes. Those processes have been developed for so long. If you work all of that in the right way, if you consciously understand what you're doing when you're doing that, I don't think the churches consciously understand that they're doing that. They just kind of do it because that's what they've been doing for so long. If they put together programs around that knowledge, the result is what I call epiphany. Epiphany is that just get it, as you said. Mm. And you know, we've watched kids just get it, and it's chilling, absolutely chilling. And I'll tell you a story about it. That whole process is what we could and should offer kids. But the institution's education is not offering it, though it offers a little bit of it. Churches are not offering it, though it offers more of that. Parents are not being able to offer that process. So kids are initiating themselves, and we know the danger of that. They don't have the constraints, and that's what gangs are. Gangs are the end result of an initiatory process where all of those things have lined up. It's the gang leader, it's the thrall, it's the rituals of the gang. You know, it doesn't have the quiet time, and it very seldom has the epiphany, but the gangs are the first three parts of that process. If we consciously understood how we could do this in churches, in school, we would take kids to a very powerful and interesting place. We do that in Chrysalis. And it works.
Dankie. Don, namens ons almal verskriklik dankie vir vir jou tyd, maar ook net die manier en die bietjie wat ek vir jou kon leer ken. Jy is so gentle en so sag en maar eintlik so hard ook. Ek vra vandag vir hom, jy gaan jy nie moeilikheid kom met die goed wat jy nou doen nie met die ondersoeke. Toe sê ek is net te oud vir die goed. As ek nou moet ek gaan. So, nou, Donse boeke is daar, ek wil net vir julle noem, hierdie is een fantastische stuk. Ek weet nie of julle kan hoor hoe hierdie man praat, maar hy is een woordsmid. Hy het regtig mooi woord. Hierdie boek is so geskryf ook. Hy het die City Press Tafelberg boekpryse gewen. Dit is, gee dit vir iemand wat jy dink dat ek iets daarmee regtig kan doen. Kom, ons geef hom 'n lekker hande klap.